past at 9, so that he must, he can spend an hour because he's having this Najwa case. He wouldn't be able to attend. But if it was 9 o'clock, you are. Then he was able to attend, but unfortunately not. So the minister and the commissioner and Mr. Mutegi is here to come and brief us on the medical parole. Minister, now let me tell you why the committee decided on this process. We are very much concerned about the issue of people, inmates, dying in prison. The committee expressed this concern because in the annual report of the inspecting judge, each and every year the judge is raising this issue of death in prison, natural death, not unnatural death, but death in prison. Now, we decided to go into this whole issue to see why what is the obstacle, why are these people not being released. For instance, the 2006-2007 annual report of the inspecting judge, not the latest one, 1,249 people, inmates, died in prison, and we don't know the causes of that. Maybe also in your presentation, if we can get the list of what was the causes of these people dying. And our last meeting, members of parliament of this committee asked a list of families that were approached for them to look after their relatives, and they have refused because the department the commissioner was telling us and the presenters were telling us that families are refusing to take their relatives when they are terminally ill. So if we can get also that out of that 1,249 an indication at least who really refused and didn't want to take their relatives, if it is possible for us to get that. But Minister, that is the reason why we are sitting here, why we have called, because it's a very serious concern to the committee that we are spending a lot of money on the office of the inspecting judge, and the inspecting judge is tabling reports each and every year and raising this issue, amongst others, raising this issue of death in prison. But it seems to us as a committee, nothing is happening to address this problem. Next year we'll get another report again, and it's one of those things in the report. So we want to take it up very seriously to say what is the problem. Can you discuss it with us so that we as the committee must also know, because we are public representatives. If people in KwaZulu-Natal, in Port Shepstone, is asking civil citizens, my relative was terminally ill or ill, and the Department of Correctional Services didn't want to release it. That person died in prison. And you know, Minister, we are visiting prison. You know, last week, I think it's Mr. Krele who raised it, to say that we go into the hospitals there, And we can see that this is boom. This person is on his way. He or she, but mostly it will be men. And we can see that this person is really going. But this person will lie there, and that is the reason, Minister, why we are here to come and talk about this thing. If there is weaknesses in the whole system, tell us. Then we will know there's weaknesses. But as an oversight committee, we must know, and we must answer to people out there why this 1,249 people died in prison, and maybe they were terminally ill or not, why they have died there. And I think that the office of the inspecting judge will also feel that they are also being taken seriously now, because they are writing reports, things are getting attention too. But let me welcome Ms. Ngwenya. Ms. Ngwenya, you are welcome to the meeting. I am going to ask the minister to open, and then the minister will tell us where to now. We are having a representative of the Office of the Inspecting Judge, Mr. Umesh, Advocate Umesh. You are welcome, sir, to the meeting. Yeah. Minister, over to you.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Let me express, first of all, my gratitude to yourself, the honorable members of the Portfolio Committee. We are at a stage where we're doing a lot of belt-tightening exercises because the envelope is not that deep. And therefore, the accounting officer emphasizes the point, that the commissioner, that we've got to exercise that belt-tightening as much as we can. Now, when I approached you on the issue of the five chairpersons per region, I approach it from that angle, but secondly, from the angle that they are not the only ones who deal with these kinds of issues. And therefore, we would like to come to the committee, myself and the commissioner and the CDCs, together to just to give the procedures that we follow when we deal with parole. And I'm saying with parole first, because yes, I'm going to break it down then to what kinds of paroles do we have. Because it's all contained under the parole system. Then you have this medical parole, this kind of parole, depending. It'll come out as we walk you through this whole procedure with the commissioner and the citizen taking. I do also apologize for the judge. He spoke to me. He took a day off yesterday to go up to headquarters. He is sitting today on this Nigel Peterson case, and he needs to finish it. But he felt if we needed to talk to him, we can actually drag him out of that case. I don't think we will do that. We'll try to take you through this whole presentation. That's my first gratitude. But my second gratitude is to the fact that you, when having read the reports of the inspecting judge, that's for 2006. That's where the 1249 comes from.
Yes.
The 2006 report.
Yes.
If you look at the 2007 report, you'll find it's 1056. So there is a little bit of tapering down. But we must just be honest in saying, when we deal with people who are in captivity, the numbers will look big because they are in captivity, unlike just in society. Because of the captive nature of their incarceration. So we also have to look at, I've raised that with the commissioner and Seki, we also have to look at the stats of health in South Africa and the statistics coming from even Home Affairs. Where are we, what are we losing people to? What is going on? and we're clear about the policy, which we'll take you through. Parole board can also play a part in it, but the vehicle through which they play a part is the CMCs, the case management committees. And I do appreciate the role that the oversight parliament plays over us. We also need to say this, Chairperson, that whenever you visit areas,
yes.
I do the same.
Yes.
You see a person and you think, as you rightly point out, this person surely can't escape. This person surely is not a threat to society. But we have an obligation. Our obligation is when courts sentence people, we cannot undermine those sentences. People have got to do their sentences. We cannot. That's the first basis of the work that we do. Because if we do, particularly at this stage when the perception of crime is quite high in the country, we cannot be seen to be going against that as the department. We've got to be careful in whatever we do. That's our first obligation, to listen to the court. So some of these cases have got to go back to the court. Some of these cases have got to be processed by us. But you also have a second obligation. Our second obligation is to the communities and the families of the victims. Remember, we're not talking about angels here. We're talking about people who have wronged other people. And on this, I just want to comment on something that really made me feel bad, and I think the chairperson knows about it. In the first amnesty that was done, I was not Minister of Correctional Services then, there was a case which was a terrible case, the state versus Ramazana, where Ramazana was released on that amnesty. Same evening, he and his twin brother killed a hotel owner in East London. It was a messy, messy situation. So that's one. So whenever we have to deal with anything that has to do with parole, think about the victims, but also think about the safety of the community. That's one case I'm just giving you. The second one, when we did our amnesty in 2004, this committee will remember we had a case which was all over the newspaper, and the chairperson called us to account. I remember that, it was hurtful.
Yeah.
One of the parolees was sentenced, not for rape, and paroled, not for rape, went on to have an allegation that says he has raped a three-year-old, if you remember that case,
yeah.
Here in Cape Town. Yeah. And after the court has looked into it, found out that it was just an allegation. But the whole thing had hit us quite badly as a department. And therefore, we're taking very bad publicity on something we didn't do. Again, I'm saying, here is a person paroled, given amnesty, allegedly going to rape a three-year-old. And of course, all of us are shocked to death. How did he get out? And it got to a point where people were actually challenging the integrity of the department in doing that. Only when we went through the whole process to find that he was not arrested in the first place for rape. He was arrested in the first place for theft. But now, he has now been accused of this. And the court case never went on because the mother of that three-year-old, who happened to be drunk at that time, woke up to find that there was nothing like that. So you can imagine what it does to the integrity of the department. I'm just giving you that kind of case. The last one before I go into this, I'll call him, I'll call him by name because I worked with him. We referred a case of a 50-year-old man to the NCCS because we can refer as the department head of center to the NCCS, Charles Desai. And Mr. Mzanywa was then released in 2005. He was 58 years old. He was sentenced when he was 20. He had served 22. So 58 minus 22. Quickly. Take off your shoes. Eh? Oh, okay. I'll ask him to take off his shoes and use his clothes. 26. He was sentenced to death. But then the sentence was commuted to a life sentence. And he did 22. And before the parole board got the recommendation from the NCCS, they went to Fort Beaufort, that's where he was released from, to his home. He had a mother, he still had a mother, to check, will you be able to look after him because he has done over 20, which is what is in the law. And the mother said, yes, I will, but I need to talk to the family next door, because he had killed a next door neighbor who happens to be the cousin to the mother. So they had to talk then to the family, and the family seemed to accept. On the day of the release, we got to know that the family has changed its mind. And the whole community was with the family and said, we don't want him. And there we were standing at Fort Beaufort prison, releasing him. And the family and the community were doing their thing, he won't be acceptable here. So you have to look at all these things. So we had to take him back and then go through the process of talking to the family, which the parole board had done. Went through that process and they said no. Totally refused. We then had to come up with another option. Alternative, there's a sister somewhere in Alice, in one of the villages. Let's talk to her. We did. And they accepted him. But right now, as I'm talking to you, he is back in his community. Because we're able to work through that together with the community and make those children whose mother he had killed to actually accept him back in the community. So there are a number of dynamics in this thing of parole as a whole. So we have those kinds of obligations that we have to look after. The last thing, the procedures that we follow. Instead, you will take us through those procedures. I don't believe that anybody should, who's not a danger to society, who is not going to cause another reaction in the society, should be dying in prison. That I don't believe. I also don't believe that when the NCCS, that's the science committee, Kampempe sits there, the science there, it's a committee of experts, when they make a recommendation to me, I have to sit at home and look through that recommendation. And in some cases, most cases, you find that I look at the age, the sentence, the profile of the person, the crime that he had committed, and all those things. And I have to make a decision. It's a difficult decision. I always believe being a politician and a executive at that, even as a politician, you've got to have one side of you. One side of you that says, I am a human being, I've got to be humane. I'm a Christian as well, so I've got to approach this. But there's one side of you that also says, got to protect those communities out there. If it's a 41-year-old who has been in prison for 20 years, which means he went in at 21 or 20, the probability or the possibility of, again, getting involved in crime is still very high. It's still very high. So age does, I do look at that. What is the age of this person? What are the probabilities of this person committing another crime? If I feel that the person is, too old to swim, can't, then you're able to say, given these circumstances, there are a number of things that you look at, and you're able to say, no, you can let this person go. But you don't just do it just by looking at the person only. You look at the profile. You look at everything. So you can go into hospital, and look at the person. The last thing, I went into a hospital and saw one of our inmates being chained to a bed, which is the correct thing. Very correct. But when I looked at him, I felt, you're wasting your time. Take off the handcuffs. But I can't just say it. I've got to write it down so that I protect the official and protect the integrity of this department myself. So I take a book, write down in red pen, I have given the order that this person's handcuffs should be removed, and if the family can come and see him, and the family can confirm that they will look after this person, I'm happy to do that. But I can't just do it by word of mouth. Because when it comes back to bite me, I'll be all on my own. When that person recovers and goes and commits another crime. And we cannot take them back. When, let's say, it's a CD4 count that's very low now. You cannot then say that CD4 count will not go up again. It might. And that person might then go on to infect other people in the community without telling them his status. So you've got to look at those things and be very careful in dealing with that. I don't think you'll take us through. I just want to mention a few things which I see here in this, for 2007. It's a whole list. We should give the committee the whole list of this. Metabolic illness and others in 2006-1, in 2007-9. Meningitis, 2007-12, in 2007-11. Myocardial infarction, in 2006-9, in 2007-9. I'm just taking you through that because those are some of the lists of things that we look at. Neurological causes and other, 3 in 2006, 9 in 2007. Obstruction, I'm not much of a doctor. It's only my wife who's a doctor, but she can't even heal me as I'm sick because she's not my doctor. She's not my daughter, she's my wife. There's a difference.
Yeah.
Yes. True. She can't be busy healing me, not to heal other people. I've got my own doctor. Pneumonia, 34 in 2006, 42, because you see the steepness of 2007 and 2007. Respiratory causes and other, 12 in 2007. Pulmonary, 8, 2006, 7, 2007. Respiratory failure, 6 and 9, that's 6 and 7. Syphilis, none, right through. 2006, stillborn babies, none. Stomach ulcers, 6 in 2006, 2 in 2007. Thyroid gland illnesses, none. Tuberculosis, 64 in 2006, 41 in 2007. Again, there is an improvement there. And I think we can say that because of our approach to diet and as well as the ARVs, and we try our best in that one. The tumors, don't ask me what tumors are, 64 in 2006 and 41 in 2007. Urinary system causes and others, 1 in 2006, none. So I'm just giving you the kinds of illnesses that are there, because there's not one illness, number of diseases and illnesses that are there. But I think once we take you through the processes that we take, then we can start discussing. The one thing I want us not to, and I'm really pleading with you, and I'm pleading with my committee members and with the media, we are not going to, it's going to be unethical, and I want to make that clear, not going to discuss a particular offender. It's unethical and it's not right. We can't do that. The newspapers have been running with that story. I'm not going to comment on that because policy is not about one offender. It's about a holistic approach. It would be unethical for me to sit here and discuss a particular person. I would not do that. Neither would I discuss the reports that I get of offenders in different centers. I don't want us to do that because it would be unethical and not correct. And therefore, I'm asking the media, do not even raise that particular issue because I will not respond to it. I would like to keep the integrity of this department as intact as possible and the integrity of our system. And therefore, the general thing that I've given you is just to give you an idea of what we deal with and how do we deal with those issues, and not one particular individual in the process. I am very sure that I will not respond to any question because I would like to protect the confidentiality between a patient and a doctor and between a family and a person and whoever. In this whole system, we have our own institutions that pick up all these things. It does not rule away, it doesn't take away the fact that Sheikh's, remember, Honorable Sheikh's family, goes and visit Sheikh's brother and see the condition and then do an approach to that head of center, and that head of center processes that. It doesn't rule it out. But it cannot be a discussion that's in the media. It's got to be a discussion that's kept within the processes of correctional services. That, to me, is what's important. Chairperson, Commissioner, and Mseki, over to you guys.
No, thank you very much, Minister. No, you see, I've said the agenda of this meeting is medical parole. We have said to the commissioner, and we have issued out a a program that we will come to the issue of Shabir Sheikh, but not today. We will come to it. It's there on our program. We are not going to, and if anyone, maybe the two of you, also want to raise it, I will call you to order. Because then our meeting that we have scheduled, that this portfolio committee has said we are going to have, we can't discuss that issue today yet. Then our meeting that we have scheduled to have a comprehensive report on that issue will be useless. We are not going to discuss that issue. We are going to discuss what is on our agenda for today. That is the bottom line. And that is a rule, not the bottom line, but that is a rule that we are dealing with medical parole, and you are going to brief us, and then we will ask questions for clarification. Minister, thank you very much for the introduction of the whole system. We are as much concerned as you. We will never ever. But let me not preempt what we are going to say. Over to you. Thank you very much, Minister.
Honourable Mr. Blum, Mr. Minister, members of the Portfolio Committee, I think quite clearly this committee would be interested in the detail and the process, and the Minister has already raised his appetite about the issues that we will be discussing. Just want to return this to the Minister. Mr. Mateki will be doing our presentation. If he's as good as his math on the fifth body. So your 58 minus 22 is
26. Is that 23? Yeah.
He couldn't get his shoes off quickly enough.
No. But, you see, he grew up on a farm.
No, I can tell you that his knowledge about policy and government programs is a lot better.
Yes, I know that.
Please be assured.
Yeah.
But no, seriously, Mr. Mateki will really take us through the issues. But I think what is important for me as the accounting officer, on the same line as the Minister is doing,
we must look at this discussion within a broader context if we do not want to just get into the juicy part. We're going to make a mistake if we don't locate it within that broader context. And for us, I think there are two points that I just want to bring to the attention of this committee. And the one is that our process of transformation, having adopted the white paper from 2005, gave rise to a number of activities that I think is beginning to pay off quite clearly. And I want to remind this committee that the white paper in itself makes provision for a number of things. Firstly, the existence of the parole board in its current form. And therefore, we should be quite clear that the actual functioning of the parole board, whereby we involve members of the community, is relatively new. And therefore, I truly appreciate the approach of this committee by saying, if there are problems, be clear. What are those problems that we can be aware of? And we will be the last to pretend, because we have a new system, fairly recent, where we're reliant on ordinary community members to make very complex decisions. And in that process, we will find that there are challenges, and that we have to, as management, continuously reflect on that and address those challenges. But we're very proud of the fact that the parole boards are in place and that they are functioning, not as effectively as we want to, but they are functioning. I think also, while Minister was pointing to the fact that certainly part of our processes may have contributed directly to the decrease in number, I think we should not underestimate the fact that since we have functioning parole boards, that would also have impacted on the number of people dying with nosocomial, because it's their job to anticipate where are those vulnerable cases and to make sure that those people are taken out of the system to die at identified death at home. But once again, we must acknowledge that not to the extent that we want to see that impact. So, on the one hand, you have the parole board, but also just to, again, for our discussion to locate this appropriately, the role of the case management committees in particular, being a central part of the process of managing parole broadly as the minister. And the fact that we, in the process of rolling out and consolidating the establishment of the case management committee, and in some instances we have them fully functioning, in other instances we have people acting, but there is a process where we are really trying to consolidate that. Because we've asked ourselves, very much as you do, for us to make the system work, where do we need to place the emphasis? And I can tell you since the beginning of this year, certainly since my term as the new commissioner, one of the things that I have done with all the regional commissioners is that they did zoom in on strengthening case management committees and the case management system and the interface between case management committees and the parole board. And indeed, in the case of parole, their role is quite indispensable. And where we begin to see problems, we'll normally see it's because that link is not as polished as we would want to be. So the case management system, the parole board system, all being part of building that broad reality. Lastly, by means of introduction, for us also to once again reiterate that we as the department, we've been extremely concerned about not only unnatural deaths, but also natural deaths within our correctional system. To the extent that earlier this year, I called a meeting of various organizations, civil society organizations, including the inspecting judge, the Human Rights Commission, the United Nations, organized labor, together with our own experts. And what we wanted to do was to really unpack this issue of deaths within correctional facilities. And this is just in response, again, to the point raised that year after year we have reports of deaths within our correctional facilities and what is it that we are doing. Certainly, that roundtable discussion was meant for us to begin to unpack this and say, what is this thing? Is there indeed an increase? And if there's an increase, what can be ascribed to? Is there a decrease? It so happens that our discussion and information provided by the inspecting judge itself was that certainly in the area of unnatural deaths, we see even in hours of a death. In the case of unnatural deaths, we see, of course, a decline in the figures. So we need to understand those things in order for us to begin to make very serious managerial decisions. So what the assurance I want to give this committee is that it's a matter that is occupying us. We have identified from that roundtable discussion where some of the weaknesses are within the system. We can reflect on that. I think the discussion itself is really, you must see it as a basis to set the scene for our discussion, and I'm sure it doesn't answer all the pertinent questions that the committee may have. But I think what I'm calling for in the same way as the minister is that we must locate this within the broader correctional system, within the parole community supervision and parole system, for us to have a proper understanding of where the gaps are. So, Chairperson, with your concurrence, I'm going to ask Mr. Matsiki to take us through the technical specifications, and then we will engage around the specific issues.
Thanks, Commissioner. Over to Mr. Matsiki.
Chairperson, thank you. honorable members, the presentation, I hope everybody has the presentation.
Yeah, it's better to do it that way.
Yeah.
Not on the screen.
Yeah. Not on the screen.
Yeah.
Chairperson, you have made a specific request for information, which part of which will leave it to the committee for the end of this day. And this will include the list of diseases for which people have died within our facilities and the relevant figures relevant for that over the last 3 years. These are the figures that the figure that the minister was referring and reading out of. We have that. 2 weeks will not have been adequate, unfortunately, Chair, to collate all the information about the families consulted who would not have wanted to take their relatives who were declared terminally ill within within our facilities and therefore refuse to, but that we commit ourselves to provide that information at the earliest possible. It's the information that is located at the center and primary at the community corrections offices. So we still have to collect all that information before going to yourself. As the minister have indicated, and the commissioner, my focus, of course, is going to be on the processes. But I also want to use this opportunity to share, like the minister has done, some of the experiences that we have had around administration and management of parole in general, but medical parole in particular. It's not a simple matter at all for ourselves as an area of focus, which is part of the reason why, as Commissioner has indicated, this is one of the discussions that we have had, but we already have had a roundtable discussion where we get different people's rights from I'm not going to spend too much time around the legal issues other than to give a context to it. One is that we take our mandate from the Constitution and from our legislation. The focus of both our legislation and the Constitution is really about dignity of people whilst in custody. That as a department, we must find all forms of ways in which we should provide incarceration that is humane, where people's dignity is forever protected. And alongside with that, as people become sick within our facilities, we provide them with medical treatment, whether on out of our own facilities or alternatively commissioning those sort of services to be undertaken by outside medical facilities. And this we do just to make sure that these people do fulfill the sentence of the court in conditions that are consistent with their human dignity. And then, of course, there is a second issue where our legislation seeks to translate the constitutional requirement into practice. And this is an area where we talk about situations which will require people to be paroled on medical grounds. And as you can see, our Section 79 of our Act do make provision that any person serving any sentence in a correctional center who, based on the written evidence, this is a point very important, based on the written evidence of the medical practitioner treating that person, if that medical practitioner diagnosed that person as being on the final phase of any terminal disease or condition, that person may be considered for placement in correctional supervision as parole. I put deliberate emphasis because these are the emphasis that at some stage or the other we may need to talk about. And now, the question may arise, Chairperson, about what, from our experience, has constituted diseases that have been over time being considered to be a terminal illness. In our view and the way we have practiced this specific area, we have conceived that a terminal illness would be that which can be defined as an active and malignant disease which is difficult to be cured and can be expected to lead to death. What it means that they can be expected to lead to death is that once that person has been diagnosed as such, what would require is for the medical practitioner indeed to then certify in writing and say, this person, in my view as a medical practitioner, is terminally ill. And there are a whole range of these diseases which historically have been viewed both within our facilities and outside as this status. Among those chapters, all of us will know that cancer is one, emphysema is another, all sorts of failures of liver, kidney, and so on are amongst others. And the rest, including the heart disease, and the rest that have been mentioned in that slide. We also know that people who suffer from HIV and AIDS also would contract any one of these diseases and therefore ultimately be considered to be terminal. One of the the criteria that medical practitioners have used in respect of HIV/AIDS patients in particular has been on the basis of the CD4 count. If that has been diagnosed as extremely low, the report will often come to say that this person is criminal and therefore we should be able to release. That is one element of consideration. And the second element critical for human dignity suppression is the issue about conciliatory and dignified death. In this regard, the basis for which this person will have been sent home would be so that this person is provided with care by people amongst whom are members of his family, his loved ones, friends, and so on. And that alongside with that emotional and physical support, that medical support is also provided to that person. So when later I talk about an evaluation of the family and signing off by the family about their willingness in particular to take this, an assessment will be made about their state of readiness to be able to provide that support, including enabling this person to continue receiving some form of medical support wherever it's possible. But as Chairperson has indicated, we have in many instances had a bit of problems in respect of that. What I'm saying is that we are not able to release anybody unless a family or some other institution has indicated their willingness to accept that person. But you remember that the emphasis is on a dignified, conciliatory death where this person is able to receive support. And so we do indeed, as you indicated, Chairperson, and this list will provide you with, have suffered a situation where members of the family do indeed say, what are we going to be doing with this person? Whatever it is going to be very costly to us. And therefore, we're not willing to take this person into our care. And I explain some of the reasons why this sometimes becomes a case. And in some instances, it takes rather relatively very long to locate this family. By and large, because what the inmate will know is this physical address, which the families over a period, for instance, in the case of the minutes of 20 years, the families might have moved or so, and therefore trying to find where this people are becomes a difficulty that they have to endure. That's the department. I also want to talk about the support that we provide to people and the circumstances which will give rise to a person being diagnosed as criminally ill. As you know, Chairperson, we can give you statistics about the number of facilities that we have across the country which provide a space for people who are ill within our facilities. In many instances, because, and I suspect this is the information that you might have shared in the previous meeting, in many instances, the number of visits by medical practitioners, I'm talking about doctors, vary between center to center, between region to region. Our experience has been that where we have entered into contractual agreements with the provincial department, the visits have been relatively higher than where we have not entered into an agreement. Now, you will know that this agreement that we entered into with provincial departments, we do pay the unit cost of referrals of people there, which is not always the case in instances where we have not entered into this service level agreement. So, unavoidably, our costs are relatively higher in those instances where we have contractual agreements than they are in instances where we don't. And so in Gauteng and Western Cape, where we have this service level agreement, you would have, as per the service level agreement, medical practitioners coming once every day. But elsewhere they'll come once a week, elsewhere they'll come sometimes once a month. Now the important thing about this visit is that it's this visit that pick up people who are terminal. So where there is a less frequency of visits, the chances are that we'll have a bit of problems in those circumstances in terms of picking up these cases. But of course, where cases are acute and critical, those centers would sometimes refer people to private medical practitioners for consideration with a specific Now, in terms of our process, Chairperson, that alongside with the explanation that I just provided, a medical practitioner or a nurse can identify a person as critical and possibly on the phase that could easily be considered as the final phase of terminal illness. Accordingly, therefore, they will then ask the medical practitioner to certify that their diagnosis is indeed true or not. And the medical practitioner will look into this case and indeed provide that certification. I must say that the medical practitioners have often found it difficult. This is the second area of problem. Have often found it difficult to declare a person as terminally ill. And so in many instances we have had to, but not just terminally ill, they have had a difficulty declaring a person as being on the final phase of terminal illness. That the person may be terminally ill is one thing, but whether this is a final phase, because then becomes a relative matter, has been very difficult for medical practitioners to do. And so you would often receive reports from medical practitioners that do not enable either the minister, the head of the center, or the parole board to take decisions on the face of the report that is received, because the law then says whatever the person should say, the person is on the final phase of a terminal illness. So once you receive a report that says the person is terminally ill, it oftentimes does not tell whether this is on the final phase or not. And of course this becomes a problem, where the minister will then, or the head of the correctional center will say, how do I take a decision on something like this, where the medical practitioner has not said to me that the person is on the final phase, and therefore ask for a second opinion. And so I'm mentioning this because you'll see a process that potentially delays decision making arising from the uncertainty on the part of the medical report that may be seen. this report will be submitted to the CMC in the case where the delegation goes to the parole board, in the case where the delegation of the responsibility is that of the minister, or it will be submitted to the head of the center in the case where that delegation is with the head of the center. And then that report will go from the head of the center to the CMC. And to the CMC is where all this pops in. In the sense where a decision has to be made and recommended accordingly. That decision and the report that gets submitted to either the head of the center or the correctional supervision and parole board must contain message that there is a person and a family willing to take this person, that the doctor has diagnosed this person as being on the final phase of a terminal illness, or also that there are people other than the family who could potentially be willing to take this person and provide an opportunity for dignified death. And then that report gets into the parole board for politician. I've just made reference to the information in the next slide number 10, about the different delegations in respect of different people who are sentenced differently. For instance, if a person is sentenced for 12 months, the head of the center takes that responsibility. Any period in excess of 12 months is the responsibility of the parole board, but in respect of the life, that responsibility rests with the minister until 2004. And those are cases, many of whom we are dealing with currently. We have not had an instance where the one of the court has been brought to be on us. And so that decision will be taken. I want to leave the two slides, Chairperson, around the procedure, because I think I've talked adequately to those sorts of slides. For instance, the point was already made by the minister that it doesn't matter how long you said. If you're terminally ill, whether your life or whatever, and you've served a year or two, it doesn't really matter. If you're terminally ill on the final phase, it should be considered for medical parole. There are very rare moments, Chairperson, where when a recommendation has been made by the medical practitioner, either the minister, the parole board, or the head of the center have rejected those considerations. where they have been presented. It's where the person, either the minister or the head of the center, has had a difficulty accepting that recommendation in the face of a number of things. And I'm going to slide number 13. One of those are the things that the minister has raised. The interest sometimes of the victim, when you look into the report, and the potential sometimes for this, some of the people to for their lives to be extended through some other forms of support, even when the report from the doctor has diagnosed the people as terminally ill. They have to take into account the matter of public safety, whilst on the other hand, balancing that public safety with the human dignity, the rights of that offender. There is also a problem of the uncertainty, as I indicated, regarding the life expectancy of the person declared to be terminally ill. I've talked about the difficulty by the medical practitioners to say, whilst I can accept and write that this person is terminally ill, but what you're asking me to say that this person is on the final phase is relatively difficult. This part of the final phase, I can certify terminal illness, there has no final phase. And so this thing creates problems about the life expectancy and therefore the risks to the public. I just want to mention three cases for you to realize the difficulty that goes with this specific issue. You have, say for the example that the minister provided to you, you have a situation where a social worker refers a person to a medical practitioner because this person has age-related illness. And the medical practitioner says this person is terminally ill. 3 months down the line after this person has been released, this person is found again within our facilities. When the same social worker asks, what happened? Because you're on the final phase of it. Says, I regained my strength whilst I was there, but whilst I was outside, my family was threatened, and therefore I went to burn the house of the person who was threatening my family. And I've been charged of arson and I've been sentenced. In the process of this counseling, you also discover that this person's wife is pregnant.
His wife is pregnant?
Yes.
You also is having steam. No, I'm asking because he was terminally ill at that time.
Yes, that's the
now he's having.
The only point I'm making is the only point I'm making is a risk to the people outside where the wife could potentially has been infected. You had a situation where two people get.
In there again, you look at the at the difficulty. Take it out, terminally ill, and all of that, recovers, but is not back here for the same offense that he had committed, but it's a new offense now. And I'm not going to go into Mr. Chairperson's team.
No.
The fact that the fact that the wife is now pregnant. So the risk to society and the fact that he's back in our center again and might just go down quickly and then again we go back to the same process.
You have two people being diagnosed terminally ill in housing and therefore they get released on medical parole. Some few months down the line, we discover that one of them is arrested in Western Cape, in Cape Town. How did you get to find this thing out? At the time when you ask for a job, they ask for a fingerprint and tested the fingerprint and discover this person is supposed to be elsewhere and not here. And then, of course, we have another set of problems. Remember, this person has been paroled. What I'm not saying is that this person is not sick. He's still sick, but perhaps not the criminal or the final thing at the time of his arrest. In KwaZulu-Natal, we have another case of one of these people being found owning a soccer club. Having been diagnosed, the person, I'm not making this case because they're fine or what, but I want to put across to you the difficulty that medical practitioners have with the phrase on the final stage of a terminal illness.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they become very, very hesitant to come to those conclusions very easily, especially in view of the fact that if a person receives very good palliative care, some people can recover. What I'm not saying is that person can be cured. That person can still be sick at some point in his life or within the year, but yes, the life chances and expectancy has improved. And so these are the risks in taking some of these decisions that we expose the public to. But I'm not going to talk about the diseases that cause most deaths in our facility.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that we can find information that can enable better because we wanted to make a contrast between the public and the diseases that cause life in our center, but we couldn't get the statistics relevant for that, so it has been very difficult. But the only point I can make about the issue of conciliatory death for people who die within our facility is that these people continue to receive medical treatment while they are within our facility. If indeed eventually people pass on, we do consult with the family, put the person in a safe mortuary, and if the family want that person to be at the mortuary of their choice, we take that person to that mortuary of our choice and pay the cost of that mortuary, including buying for that family a package for burial. If they don't want this person to be buried at the cemetery of their choice, that person will be buried at the cemetery that the department will choose, and will invite the family members to be there during the burial to perform their ritual. So the point I'm really making is that this is not people dumped somewhere because their families do not want them, and for us waiting patiently for them to die. We continue providing whatever care and support that is necessary for those people to die still the conciliatory death that our law provides. Of course, we then talk about the statistics. Both the Minister and Commissioner have talked about the statistics in respect of medical parole that has been granted. You would realize that in 2006-07, our statistics talks about a total of 81 and then a total of 50 in the course of the previous financial year. We have also broken the statistics down for you in respect of different regions and so on. I just want to point you to those statistics in respect of housing and in particular in Western Cape, and for, just to bring your attention to note that those statistics there are relatively higher than elsewhere, with the exception in respect of housing and Western Cape. And our assessment can only be that this is just a result of the service level agreement that we've had there, where people get seen every day by medical practitioners. Now, Chairperson, I have, in making this presentation, I have made admission of two things. One is that is the difficulty in respect, I'm taking to the last slide really around the challenges and remedies. One, of course, is the challenge about medical practitioners diagnosing people as being on the final phase of a terminal illness. I've had discussions with Commissioner about this to say perhaps part of what we can do as part of an ongoing process is to try and make a deliberate focus, discuss with provincial departments of health, and try and say, let's go check on an ongoing basis for a period of 3 months and see if our statistics will change. I said earlier on that the continuous assessment of these people, which assessment by medical practitioners should be able to say in one of the people. But we are ready, at the instruction of Commissioner, to try and say to the Department of Health, just be relatively bit more intensive, check particular set of cases and report about them on an ongoing basis and see if you may not be able to reach a stage where you can feel comfortable to say to the Department that any one of these people is on the final stage of a terminal illness. So that is part of the intervention that we will make in the next few months. But I've also said, Chairperson, that our The procedures of the CMC going to find family and so on, not finding even so on, are also relatively long. If I can make an example around the length of this period, is that in Eastern Cape, the minimum period it has taken is 2 weeks to identify the family and run the system from the beginning to the end. Three weeks in the Free State. In Gauteng for that has been 2 to 3 weeks as well. And the longest in Western Cape to try and put the person out has been approximately 2 months. So you can see that the person has been diagnosed as ill today, and 2 weeks later we are able to finalize our process, find the person, or anything could have happened during that time. And this may account sometimes from that person dying in within and not outside. So we will try and review this procedure of the person and try and see where the gap is which creates this, the length of time, which sometimes, as I say, is a bit unfortunate. I think I'll stop there, the person around this procedure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much,
Commissioner. You want to add?
Please, yeah. Please.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Mr. Wattek. No, I think perhaps just the dimension that we should add, since you were keen to have the parole board chairperson here, I thought to help you along, I'll contact a number of them. Also just to hear their views about what some of the issues are in relation to medical parole. And I think it's... the value of this discussion, of course, gives us an opportunity to reflect intensely once again about what possibly we can do. And as Mr. Mateki reported, I think one of the critical challenges is the speed at which we're able to move once someone has been found to be in the final stages of parole. I think what is required often is a parole board who is really activist-like. People who are ready to go into our hospitals and to observe for themselves. Because given the complexity of diagnosis, it's often very difficult for people to get to the point of referring this case to the parole board. And I think what we have seen in cases where there are parole chairpersons who are a lot more involved in accident life, we see the numbers going up. Of course, it doesn't in any way say how they deal with the risk after having decided to take the system out and that system recovered. That's the one thing. The second issue is that our system, they do complain, has one critical criterion that determines whether the person is placed or is the confirmation of the address and the willingness of the family to accept this person. And often the system is a bit tedious to get to that decision. In fact, generally, while you have social reintegration officers at some of the big centres, you know, their role should have been to, once they identify a case, to go and confirm the address and speed up the process. But invariably, what they do is to refer to the social reintegration office outside, who would put these cases as part of their normal caseload, and they don't necessarily prioritise them. And I'm saying these are some of the inherent weaknesses. We clearly need to find a system where we say that community corrections must find a way of prioritizing these people. We need to find a system where we have a dedicated team of people that zoom in to cases of medical parole. So that we don't only say that we are committed to ensuring that people's rights are protected and they die dignified, but that we're also able to deliver on those promises. So the chairpersons are largely saying that if we need to look at the processes and the systems to make it sure for these decisions to happen faster. If we begin to look at the statistics, you know, Mr. Mateki said that in certain circumstances, like when we have a certain level agreement with the Department of Health, we see a positive correlation, the numbers are high. I think what we are doing is to look at what some of the other factors are. clearly, where you have more experience, but also interest in to see a much better rate of placing people on parole than some of the newer ones. So it comes also with the confidence and the experience. But I think that's where we have to zoom into our processes to ensure that the soon after diagnosis, we can move as easily as possible. So that often the people who die are those where we've not acted, but we have realized that there may have been a need for intervention. But Chairperson, I'm sure we will be ready, unless the Minister wants to comment, to allow the committee to ask us very specific questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Maybe I need some clarity on an article that I saw in the. I thought that you are going to brief us about that. I think it was yesterday, in yesterday's paper, that Judge Desai was commenting about looking into changing laws for sick people. Ernest Crick was on SAFM this morning on the very same issue. So I just need clarity on that so that we can engage in that to look into changes of to accommodate sick inmates in prison. Yeah, clarity.
Chairperson, yes, indeed, I have also seen the article, and you're right. It was attributed to Judge Desai, who is the chairperson of the National Advisory Council. And as you know, according to law, the National Advisory Council can advise the minister at his request or on their own accord. And I really interpreted this to be the National Council chairperson being responsive to public debate and say, let's open it up and let's see if there is really a basis for us to look at legislative changes. So it's an initiative that we certainly understand comes from the chairperson of the National Advisory Council and quite within their mandate to do so. From an accounting officer perspective, I think for as long as the legislation remains as narrow as it is in terms of defining it as terminal illness, it does place a kind of limitation on us, given the definitional problems of what constitutes terminal illness, because any simple disease can be life-threatening when you enter the correctional system. That's the bottom line. And therefore, we do not have to be dogmatic about it. And my discussion with the minister recently, we were saying, look, we are the policymakers. We have to come here and say this is a gap. And so therefore, if the legislation, by defining it in narrow terms, does provide no options for them, we should say that. And so clearly, we are also saying that there may be cases where the issue of terminal disease, because of its difficulty, we may want to say, what are other circumstances in which the person is likely to die if the person doesn't receive the appropriate treatment? And is there a need for us to review the legislation that makes it possible for us? Other than us setting precedent, I'm sure, and I said to the Minister, I'm sure if we go back to the history, we will find that there's been precedent in this case. And we certainly would want to, as part of our own administrative process, look back to see whether there's been precedent set where people have interpreted this medical release differently. So I'm saying we need to constantly be responsive to the demands of our time without us being too oversimplifying the matters of medical parole. The changes that we are looking at is certainly from our side immediately administrative changes. And secondly, when it comes to specific individual and their circumstances, to individualize and to make sure that we do not look only at the issue of medical parole, because the basic issue here is that we must ensure that the person gets the best medical treatment as well, whether we can provide for that or not. That's our first obligation. And medical parole is a subsequent consideration after that. So administratively and legislatively, I'm happy that Judge Desai indicated that they're looking at it because we have a dilemma and simply shows that they are open and responsive to that. And we are looking at our own systems and procedures to talk about it.
Now, when I saw that that article, and even this morning, listening to Mr. Crick, I said to myself, we must be very, very careful. Very careful. You see, the minister raised now issues in his introduction of people being released, and Mr. Mteki as well now, about this. Now, if we open a gap, we must be very, very careful. And you see, that thing will come to us. We will look into it. But I'm saying we must be very careful in not going to open up a thing. You know, inmates are having very expensive advocates, very expensive lawyers, and we will open a gap. I'm saying let us apply our minds, not go into a thing that will backfire on us again, according to me. But we will wait for that thing. According to me, you see, Mr. Mteki raised a lot of challenges. You see, of this person was released on parole, medical parole. He was terminally ill, diagnosed by the. My first question will be: are we not having second opinion from doctors? If this person is being diagnosed as terminally ill by a doctor, are we not having second opinion and third opinion for that matter? If we are not sure. That is my first question. The second question: are we not putting conditions? You see, this act of Correctional Services Act, when a person goes out, it's either the commissioner or the parole board. You see, there is house arrest. There's a lot of things. Now, if this person can go out and do this thing of going to rape and whatever, then there's a question mark. Then there's a question mark. Are we not monitoring this person? Are there no conditions set for this person? If he is able to do all these things, we are not. You see, and parole. Or medical parole. This person is not free. That is what the Act is saying. This person is still under the supervision of Correctional Services. So we can't leave this person and say, no, this person is now free and this person can go. It is the department's task to implement what is in the Act. But I'm giving members chance to ask questions. I have raised two questions. Mkosi Paul.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you again for the presentation. Chairperson, I'll ask my questions based on the challenges that the department is faced. My first question, Chairperson, will be: at what stage of the sentence do you diagnose health status of the offender, especially in light of HIV/AIDS? Prevalence. The second question is: how do you mobilize and build family and community network to ensure strong support system during aftercare? Why I'm asking these questions, Chairperson? I'm worried about the department, the way they present this medical aid, in terms of the safety of the community. I'm worried, Chairperson, because the department doesn't tell us that in terms of these families that doesn't want to accept their people when they are ill, especially in Gauteng. I'm at Gauteng. I'll be happy if they can give even the numbers of those houses, so that maybe I can go with my management team in my constituency to visit those families, seeing that we must know that really is the truth that the families doesn't want to accept their loved ones. I'm worried, Chairperson, because now it looks like Minister Sibenzi Zangoma apha. Can you see this as we implement that act? Yokuthi abantu uma noma ngabe beboshiwe beboshelwe ubona umphakathi ngaphandle banalo ilungelo lokuthi nabo babonelelwe ukuthi bahambe bayolala ngokuthula kepha bese siphazamiswa ukuthi ama families abo aphikisana nalokho okuyikuthi manje fanele sibe zizangoma thina ke zokuthi odokotela abakhuluma iqiniso abantu abaguli. I don't like that example of saying that the person that was out with that medical doctor and after that person usebonakala sekwenye indawo, it looks like now we don't have any confidence in our doctors. Okuyikuthi maybe now if we said we don't have confidence, that means we need to apply 3 or 4 or 20 certificates to make sure that person is sick. So as is on is angle. So we want to the department to give us all the house numbers of those inmates that are sick. Because when you look at the report, you'll find that the statistics is low in terms of releasing these people. Then, as a committee, what can we help if we don't get the reality of the community that doesn't want to accept their loved ones? I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Mengwen. Nkosi Kot.
Chairperson, thank you very much. And good morning, Mr. And the National Commissioner and his wife. My problem, Chairperson, stems from what you have just mentioned. In Potchefstroom, some years ago, when people were applying for old age pensions, they were asked to submit a certificate.
That is an old age pension. For old age pension now. All right.
They were asked to submit medical certificates to confirm their ages and that they are in fact elderly people that were qualified to get pension. Each time they get to a doctor, Mr. Chairperson, they would bring an ID and inside the ID there would be a 50 rand or a 100 rand note meant for the doctor. And the doctor realizing this, without any verification of any sort, summarized the certificate, put his stamp and officials. And here, again, the same medical practitioner, there's no provision for any senior doctor to certify that this is in fact correct. This man must be given a medical parole. I'm worried about what will happen thereafter. He will go home, you know, Chairperson, they say, I have a problem. I don't know. But he, Uglan Mzalo Wato, as men will understand me, is equal to 1 kilometer run. Now that this person has been given a medical role, he's sick, he's not right. You can see in his eyes, this man is just about to die. But then in a month's time, we are going to pick him 1 kilometer run. Usizo chinike kulwa dokotela who gave him a medical certificate to the teacher. That's my question.
Yeah, please. Okay.
All right. Ngoskot. Angizikhumshale. Uzoyithetha isifungulo isiXhosa. Kuyenzeka ukuthi umuntu egule engaphilanga njalo. Azale ukudlala umdlalo wodwa. Lo mdlalo wodwa wenza ingozi. Ngiyeki lapho. Akusiyo aki kadokotela leyo.
What the minister is saying is when a person is so sick, he can't run for 1 kilometer. That's what the minister
It's not the doctor's problem, really. It's the problem of the person trying to run that kilometer. I'm putting it in that kind of sense.
Yeah.
But let me do this. The thing about Jack Desai as the chair of the NCCF advisory committee to us, what you have said, Chairperson, is what worries me. I've read it. I've read that article. One of the things that we need to do is not to open ourselves up for abuse. The minute we put in sicknesses in there and saying any person who is sick to this extent will have the floodgates open. And I've said from the beginning, we're not dealing with angels. We are not dealing with angels here. We're dealing with people who have wronged society. And therefore you've got to be extra careful. Think of the victims. Think of the families. The victims of the families. You cannot just open up. If Nwande Balfour is diabetic and he has wronged society, and we can contain the level 2 or whatever of diabetes in prison, then we can do that. We can give him medication to look after him. But it should not be a situation where a person wants to bypass the sentence and use then whatever sickness. And I'm not saying that diabetic people are not. Diabetic is chronic. I'm diabetic. It's chronic. It can be controlled. It can be looked after. In this one, we are talking terminally final stages. And the thing with Segi is explained it, because even with doctors, it's difficult for them to write that down. Because they don't know. They are not God. They don't know. So we've got to be extra careful. Therefore, whatever legislation that comes our way from the advisory board will come to yourselves as legislators. And we need to scrutinize it and make sure that it doesn't open loopholes and it doesn't open floodgates. So that's very important. Court system and the judicial system should never be undermined. Because the minute we do legislation that undermines what the court's judgments are, then we might as well close shop and go home. Because if Carol then feels, I've got sinusitis, and writes it down and said, my sinusitis is so chronic that I've got to be out of prison, then for every little sickness, people will get out of prison. So we can't. So on legislation, I would like to see what the judge Desai is saying. I haven't listened to Ernst Crick, but I do trust Ernst because he's been there for a long time, although it's his last month, he's retiring now. It was his birthday last week. He's 60 at the end of the month. Mr. Crick is finished now with correctional services.
On 60 years, actually, and he's going. He's
yep.
still very young.
It's Correctional Services Act.
And I'm still working, I'm 66.
Correctional Services Act 111. Of 1998 amended. So if you want to amend that, Mr. Bloom, please feel free. There's something called the Members' Bill.
Yeah.
Feel free. So we can talk about that. But for now, it's 60 for correctional services.
Yeah.
So the monitoring, I want to come back to the monitoring. We do monitor people. When they get out, whether they are under medical parole or parole, anything under parole, there is monitoring, which includes regulations and magisterial districts. Is it magisterial? Yes. Magisterial districts that they have to be under. But in some cases, I must admit, in some cases, Because people will need to work, and I'm not talking only medical here, I'm talking about paroles.
Mm.
People need to work, and we do encourage people to work. If a person has to work in Gauteng, and the paroles were done in the Eastern Cape, and they asked, in writing of course, I've got a job with Mr. Peterson in such and such a place, and Mr. Peterson then confirms in writing that this particular person has got the job. We have no reason, and I'm repeating this, no reason to stop that person from getting a job. Conditions still apply, but then that person is transferred from one magisterial district to the next, so that correctional supervision can take place there. I think we understand another on that. So in terms of what they do, there are conditions. But if they're staying at home with Carol, and Carol has actually agreed to sign and say, they'll be staying, he'll be staying with me and what have you. There's one thing you cannot monitor. You can't monitor what they do with Carol in that house. You can't monitor that. You can monitor the movement out of that Marcel district. But if they sit there, alcohol abuse, no ways, no, no, no. But when you knock at 10 and say, parolee so-and-so, are you here? And he appears at the door, and you are able to say, come closer, smell or whatever, whatever is on his breath, and then you are able to write and say, he was at home at this given time. When you leave, what that parolee with Carol do in that house, you don't know. I'm not sure if you get my drift.
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
So you there are conditions you can monitor. Let's come to second opinion. Very good question, Mr. Bloom. Lusikisiki, 2006, we released an offender from Durban, Westfield. We found out that the family is in Lusikisiki. I remember that case very well. We spoke to the family. Fortunately, we have a prison in Lusikisiki. Unfortunately, there is a site, an ARV site, in the clinic in Lusikisiki. So the offender needed that. Spoke to the family, mother and father, and they agreed, and they said they'll look after him. He went to Lusikisiki. They looked after him. He recovered. There is no way in law we can take that offender back. As long as he has not broken any of the parole regulations and rules. Unless he commits another crime. But there is no way you can take him back and say, you've recovered. Come back. Come in and finish that. No, you can't. That will be wrong in law. And I know it's not what the care person wants to hear. But it's still wrong in law to take that person back. Without that person breaking any law. If they stick to the conditions and the regulations, I think, am I right, Commissioner?
Yes.
We have to allow that person to continue with his or her work. So we do get second opinion. I remember with him, we got a second opinion. The doctor in KwaZulu-Natal was, she's here now, Rodeskir. I'll tell you, the doctor, who we agreed to go and see this person. And she did, came back with a second opinion. We get second opinions as much as we can. There's no way you can just take the word of a doctor who's been treating that person. Even in cases which you know of, we get second opinions all the time. We do. With our own doctor, if a person has his own doctors outside of our center, we get our own doctor to get a second opinion. So that we can never move away from. At what stage, after a sentence has been started, very difficult, depending on the frailty of the person, the physical condition of the person, and depending on the stage of the terminally illness. But can I also be very, very strong on this one? You can't get him today, sentenced for 15 years, and then tomorrow you tell us that you are terminally ill and therefore you need to be released. I will not agree to that. I am sorry. I cannot agree to that. You can't get in today. You've got to do part of your sentence. You are sentenced by the court. We've got an obligation to to the court to uphold the law. So you can't just get in today and next week you say, I'm so terminally ill that I need to get out. No, no, it can't happen. So we've got to look at all these criteria. And I'm not saying that I'm God, I can decide on, no, I can't. But I've got to respect the law and the laws of this country.
But so, what do you mean by
then go school. Okay. Okay, the safety of the community, Mamuini, is paramount. It is very paramount. That is why we go out of our way to talk to the families, get the address, get everything, get the families to say, we agree, we'll look after him, here are the conditions. And then the community as a whole participates, and that's why we have community corrections, participate in looking after this particular person, so that there are no problems. It's not all the time that we get it right. Sometimes we don't get it right. And the involvement of our constituency offices with our legislators like yourselves would be very good. And therefore, I welcome that. That constituency offices should help us in doing this kind of monitoring and talking to the communities, because you are steeped in that culture of talking to communities. I was just going through some of these issues. So aftercare is very important, that communities and families participate in that as much as we can. In terms of medication, if we cannot give medication, and I want to touch the commissioner will touch on that, sometimes our facilities don't have the kind of medication that some of our offenders need. We will take that person to a public facility to get that medication. Sometimes they need certain instruments which we don't have within the facility. Instruments that will measure this and this and that, and we don't have that. Again, we'll go out of our way to make sure that they get that kind of facility. But there will be a report that comes in on a weekly basis to the minister. If not to me, say to the commissioner. It doesn't even come to the office. It doesn't, of the minister, because I don't want anybody, don't want Amelia or anybody or George to pick up reports of doctor's condition. It's between the doctor and the patient, and the minister has given the report. So I get the report in my house, read through the report, and again phone and say, get another practitioner to look into that. Because I don't want people's sicknesses and illnesses to be bandied around, because we want to protect their dignity. So we do get those kinds of reports. But again, time and again, the challenge is of getting families to agree on a lighter note. It's not even a medical parole I'm talking about. There's a young lady in Portsmouth, and I've read this story twice now. Natalie is in Portsmouth. I'm not saying her name is Natalie. I'm giving her name. I know the media is going to be jumping.
Yeah.
She's been there for some time. The family has never visited her. The mother, she's got a mother. The father is in prison somewhere else. The mother has not visited. So one time I'm in Portsmouth, she says to me, Minister, if you can phone my mother now, I'll give you a number. Phone and tell her that I died last night. You'll see what happens. I did. I phoned her, told her, Mrs. So-and-so, Natalie has just passed away and what have you. She was angry. Of course, every parent has got the right to be angry. And she said, by 2 o'clock, I'll be there in Portsmouth to find out what happened to her. I waited for her. She came. And I was sitting with Natalie. And I said, bring her through. So he brought her through. She got there, phone Natalie. I said, good. Good afternoon, Mrs. Sullivan. I said, yes, your daughter. You've never even bothered to come and see her. But now you're coming in real full force, in steam. A la Jefferson, you're coming in full steam because you want benefits now. You want to challenge us and get benefits. So we do get that, those kinds of situations. And if, as parliamentarians, you go out there and you get those kinds of situations, please help us. Help us to challenge those families to say, you are going to be the first one to come in here and knock on our door when your relative dies in prison, when you didn't want to take care so that he or she can die in a dignified manner within the family. I'm just giving examples. Because medical parole is not just medical on its own. It's parole as a whole. These kinds of criteria that you find in paroles. But we do need your assistance in that. And if we need to you to give us, you need us to give you the information, we definitely will do, Mamwe. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister. Thank you. Commissioner?
Thank you, Chairperson. No, I'm just amazed. I'm listening to my minister, and I think extensively my minister will go for some of the inmates. It's just the same minister. We often don't go to the same extent, but that's on the lighter note. I just want to pick up on two issues. The one is the question posed by Ms. Nguyen on the issue of the health status and when we diagnose inmates. I think part of our admission process is indeed a health screening by a list. So, of course, we do that as a general screening, but as you know, we still constitutionally and otherwise approach the issue of HIV and AIDS as really testing and voluntary testing based on counseling. So there's not going to be any obligatory screening of a prior condition when the person enters our business, other than the very general health screening. So I hope that answers that question.
Can I just jump in, Commissioner? Like the Pretoria Waterproof 4, right? By last night, we knew that three of them had presented themselves to the Pretoria Central Administration Area. And they had to be screened last night, the three. The one who's in Cape Town will be doing that today. So they are in, they'll be screened and medically examined. And then after that, the head of Central will decide where they go. So they are going through that right now. By the time we get to Joburg this afternoon, Pretoria will know where exactly have they been placed after going through that. Even the one that will come in today will go through that process.
Thank you. So the second question you asked, I think is a very important question. And I think the Minister has alluded to the importance of members of this committee to the various constituent offices and elsewhere to play a role in respect of helping us to persuade families to care for ill inmates with disease. But I just wanted to look at it as part of our own reflection, because you know the one thing that we constantly have to reflect on is the fact that often shepherds and many of these people come from extremely impoverished communities where there's unemployment, all kinds of conditions. And by releasing a terminally ill patient into their care, right, it's really adding to the burden of care. And I'm not saying that is an excuse.
Uh-huh.
I'm saying that in some instances, it's really unfair to families to expect at the last stages of terminal illness and insist you take care of these people when there may be a single parent having to go out to fend for the rest of the family. And this person will remain uncared for during the day, the better part of the day. I'm not saying that we should not do something about it, and I think this is where we need to begin to see the interrelatedness of policies and programs, and I think particularly of the Department of Health and Social Development, the notion of community and home-based caregivers, and how we make sure that our own services network effectively, so that when we do have situations like that, we're able to access the services of volunteers or even stipendiary workers who may be home and community-based caregivers. So I think we need to understand and therefore do something directly to deal with that. We have spoken the last time when we reflected with this committee around the issue of the HIV AIDS and prevalence, but we shared with the committee also some initiatives for some people looking at alternative places of care. You know, not only hospices, because we know, again, hospices, it's very expensive to run, and family members, again, can't afford care offered by hospices. But we've indicated there are some NGOs who are quite keen to revisit the issue of after housing. So we need to look at various models in which we can facilitate this process. And I just want to thank you. I think we need to open up the discussion to make sure that community-based structures, particularly the home and community-based care workers, are also become part of the resource that the role board chairperson can utilize to make sure that there is adequate support. I don't know, Mr. Matek, if your other questions that you think you may have.
There is another element to the point you are making to Ms. Mkwe, which of course is the issue that I'm saying more. Remember I talked about identification and confirmation of addresses. A complementary element that goes with that, which I think is the point that Commissioner is making, is that you can't pick up a person having identified the address and go dump that person there. So there is a process of counseling. There is a process of ensuring that people don't end up receiving what they did not expect. I mean, one time you love this person, and you want him to be here, but you're not expecting the person you're going to see sick today. And so there is a process of trying to reconcile that, of providing emotional support and counseling to the families and social workers. One of the things that the CMC does is to make sure that there is a report of the social worker that accounts for the counseling of the family in respect to the fact that the person is going to be released on parole and the circumstances of that person during that time.
Mengwin and Mr. Tsai.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm also worried about this Chairperson of the parole. To me, it looks like they're not working as we want them to do their work, Chairperson. Because if really they're doing their work in terms of informing the community about this parole, I don't think that we have this problem that we have. I feel that Chairperson, maybe we need also to check with these Chairpersons of the parole board. What role are they playing in terms of the situation that we are faced right now? I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Mengwe. Mr. Skyler?
Well, thanks, Chairperson. A follow-up for not mentioning it. I wanted to check from the department how often do they get reports from the chairpersons of these parole boards and the challenges that are facing them as the chairpersons. Secondly, can the department seriously engage with these other seven provincial departments of health in order to lower the number of deaths in our prison? And lastly, Chairperson, this one comes from you directly. I'm not saying the scheme this time.
Yeah.
What measures do you have as the department to judge the risk of reoffending, particularly with regard to sexual offenders? I'm raising this question because the outcry outside about the rapes of our children, old mothers, grandmothers. Do we have a system of trying to check if we can release this sexual offender because he's terminally ill or not? Thanks.
That's exactly, before you respond, that's exactly what I wanted to ask now. With this test that you have released them, can you indicate to us how many of these people were in for sexual offenses? And what were their conditions after you have released them? Because it will be a very dangerous thing. And I can tell you now, from this portfolio committee, will never ever support a thing where a child raper, a raper of women, a person who has committed very serious and dangerous crimes, must all of a sudden be an angel, be treated like an angel inside. That is what we must be very conscious of the society and the safety of society out there. Now, can you please give us an indication? If you don't have it, yeah, it's fine. You can send it.
But Mr. Kelle's question is relevant, that we must have an indication out of this 75 of 27 that was placed on medical parole. How many of them were in for rape? How many of them were in for dangerous crimes? The minister have released alive a year. What was his offense? And so on. Please, thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the officials will take on the stats and everything. Just on that one, it's so difficult. When you get the profile of the offender, let's say it's a lifer, for instance, in my case, you look at the profile and the crime that the person has committed. And I think I mentioned in the beginning, you go through a lot of emotions yourself when you have to release that person. Mm-hmm. Looking at the probability of reoffending, whether they have done sexually, committed sexual a crime or anything like that, you still have to go through that as an individual. And in most cases, that I myself would disagree sometimes, what I would say to the NCCS, not on this one. I don't agree with the recommendation. So let the person stay. I'm not going to do that. The second thing, difficult to go into the numbers. They will have to go to the, I'm sure we've got the numbers. Sexual offenses are very serious offenses. You don't take chances. There's an 84-year-old man who is in Middle Drift at the moment for rape, raping a 13-year-old. You look at him, he is on a wheelchair. He can't walk. And of course, you become humane and you want to know, what did you do? Mm. And when he says rape, or you look at his profile, you then end up saying, forget about it. I'm a father of three daughters, and I cannot see myself releasing this kind of person. You just have to stay until you reach that terminally ill situation where we know you won't be a risk to society. So not the only one. Mm. There are others that are mamas there, where you look at their physical condition, but you end up saying, I'm not going to do anything because these are pests that have sexually molested people. Mm. Therefore, I'm not going to even think about it. So the statistics I'll give you. Mm. There are seven health departments. In fact, we'll talk about that. I think we have a very good relationship with the other departments, but they'll talk about it. The reports of chairpersons do come, and we've done a lot of training with the chairpersons, and citizens they will tell you, I try and drive them as much as I can. There are two areas which I feel I want to take responsibility for, and hands-on, is the issue of those parole boards, because I say this is a legacy that we have created. And therefore, we need to know what is their optimal output as they work throughout the week. I want to know what is their optimal output. How many cases do they do per day? And how many cases do they do per week? Because we're paying them money. And they are supposed to go out there to talk to communities. It's their responsibility. And to say to communities, we are parole boards, this is our role. We are supposed to do this. How do you feel? Get the views of the communities, where we are going to release people or where we are going to not to recommend the releasing of people. So those chairperson's reports are something that I put my emphasis on. We must get them all the time. At the last time I spoke to him, say it was 15 cases they are doing per day at the minimum. Am I right? More or less 15, but I'm saying to them, not less than that, cases per day. But remember, the areas they work in are vast sometimes. They have to look after about six or three or four or five facilities. But you still push them to do whatever. Some of these parole boards are roving parole boards. They don't sit in one place because of the vastness. They rove from one place to the other. But still, you push them as much as you can to get the work done. Not because we want people to be just released, but because we believe that those who deserve to be released must be released. And I keep on saying, with that emphasis, they are not angels. Even when we talk about children in prison, we're not talking about angels. We are talking about criminals. Some of them have offended society. And therefore, don't treat them as if they are angels. They are not angels. Yes, they are human beings, but not angels. The last thing is just the issue of contributing. It's so critical that they have to do this contributing as much as they can. Go to churches, go to schools, go to everywhere and talk about the work that they do. Community corrections, to me, is still one vehicle we have not utilized optimally to do that kind of work. Because community corrections has got to help the parole board to go out to those communities. And it's where I get very angry sometimes. When you go to a community corrections office and you find that it's a guagege, everybody's doing whatever they like. I hate that. I don't know what guagege is in English. It's just a free-for-all thing. Free-for-all thing.
Yeah.
And I've said to community corrections, to corrections, I'm saying, we need to overhaul that system immediately and get good people in there, good managers. Because parole boards will then work much, much better if you have good managers in community corrections. Then social integration can work much, much better within our communities. But if you are to take people that are problematic within our centers and just throw them at community corrections, you're not doing us a favor. Because it's our vehicle to link up with communities. If we're saying it's a societal responsibility, corrections, then it's important that society is at the center of what we do. So they'll talk about some of this, the statistics. I'm just talking about the overall approach.
Thank you, Minister. Commissioner?
With the permission of the Minister, and I would want to use this section from the commercial. I think the question around sexual offenders is a very important question. And I'm not going to pretend to be an expert. Minister, in 2 weeks' time, we have the International Association for the Treatment of Sexual Offenders coming to this country to host an international conference where we're going to have all the experts globally to talk around this phenomenon. And Minister Balfour, I hope he will agree, I've extended his submission to open the keynote today. And we will also host a function for the delegates at the Cape Town Hotel. And so certainly, I hope as many members of the board for can go, certainly to act, certainly for the gala dinner towards, I think, 2 weeks from now. But we'll provide you with the details for the media. It's going to be a very important conference. And of course, we're also using the opportunity to use these experts to give some pre-conference workshops to train our own people around issues of sexual offences. So that's on the one. But I think I will, as a form of practice and social work, attempt to comment on the issue of sexual offenders. And I do know from my own experience, members of this committee will know that we still do not have reliable statistics on recidivism or reoffending for offenders generally in this country. It's very, very difficult for us to do that research. We have had a project that we have undertaken with the Center for Security Studies to help us develop a model to measure recidivism and the different categories. But of course, the variables are quite difficult. Do you measure it from the time offenders are being arrested or a case is being recorded as a cause or when the system enters the system? What then is the measure to be used to determine recidivism or reoffending or successful rehabilitation for that matter? Very complex area. What we do know from international best practice is that if it's so difficult to measure reoffending in the offender population generally, I can tell you it's even more so in the case of sexual offenders. What I can say without fear of contradiction is that the successful rehabilitation for sexual offenders is generally regarded as the lowest of all crimes committed. So yes, indeed, when you do say that a sexual offender is to be released on parole or you know, medical parole, it must raise certain alarm bells. Mm. And that is why you will know that in societies and in South Africa, more recently we have introduced the whole idea of, you know, of a register for sexual offenders in order to make sure that we begin to monitor these people on an ongoing basis, broadly speaking. So yes, it is a concern, and the prognosis for rehabilitation is extremely low, and there's always a risk of reoffending. Of course, I think having said that, the point that the committee has raised earlier of what measures do we build in to make sure that our monitoring remains effective. Yet again, the minister pointed out the difficulties of not knowing what people do 24 hours. And I think we have been before this committee again to talk about us beginning to see if technology can help us do this better for people on parole and alternative sentences. And so that's still a project that we're looking at with the CSIR, the issue of electronic monitoring, and whether that indeed, under South African conditions, will help us to improve on our ability to track what people are doing. Because these are serious matters. On the issue of statistics, of the numbers of people having released on medical parole, unfortunately we don't have the specific breakdown in it. But it's easy for us to do that analysis and to provide the committee with that. Ms. Fredon can just make sure that that information is available. Thanks.
Thanks.
I can only bear witness that the issue of I signed this thing before they go to the minister or the MCS, and I've seen him in action refusing altogether to budge on the issue, in particular of sexual offenders. And at one point, I just wish I could have that ruling where he has said no. But the judge made very scathing remark against the decision that the other person took his decision for review by the court, and the court released that person. So I'm making a point that this is not an easy interface between us and everybody else around the specific issue. So I can bash around that. But it's not only the chairperson, the chair of the parole board. Remember that we have community members there. As well, and many of these people are not taken because they are unemployed. They are taken because of their profile in the community. But because, for instance, of what the minister is saying, 15 cases are not an easy thing in one day. They take practically the whole time through. So you're left with relatively little time to do anything else. And so we've talked with them around the point that they're making, that they need to take responsibility. Not to put us in a situation where they look like us. Because one day when they are members of the department, in the eyes of the public, the decisions then go back to be the decisions of the department and people employed by them. So we keep on talking to them that you need to maintain your profile to be the person that you have always been in your communities and be so that the decisions you take here can have a bearing, can be representative of the community sentiment. That's one thing. But of course there has been a problem, of course, with this one, which we are trying to deal with. For instance, a member of the community can decide in a roving parole board that I'm going to a particular community, and when she comes back from there, she has expanded out of her own pocket. Right? And so she wants to be compensated. It has not been easy to deal with those specific set of cases. So we're on the verge of completing a manual, practice manual to try and make sure that both the chairperson and members of the community can do this thing freely without being hindered by the fact that they expend out of their own pocket, and sometimes we refuse to pay them. We will engage with the Department of Health in different provinces, but if I must make an example of chairperson in contact,
why are you picking up? Why?
Because I know you'll help immediately.
Your hometown.
Okay.
Home advantage.
It has not been easy getting medical practitioners to. You asked the question about the second opinion. It would not matter the second opinion with the medical practitioner that you in contact, because they refuse flatly to write about terminal illness. For the obvious reasons that I have outlined earlier on, it's not an easy thing even for the medical practitioner. The issue of, in particular, final phase of a terminal illness. So we're struggling around that specific area. But we'll talk with the Department of Health around this matter. We'll further engage even the private practitioner that will continue to use over time in instances where, because it's not like all private Department of Health have got abundance of people. So we'll carry on engaging even the private practitioners as well. But we will try and provide the statistics. They're not a difficult thing to provide, especially around sexual offenses, because that has been a very serious nightmare around how do you control something like that. So it will not be difficult to provide those statistics.
In this case that he's mentioning, I don't want to mention the judge. I can't mention I want to. I won't mention the judge. But the when I turned it down, there were three guys, turned it down. We then went back to Judge Desai and said, this is not correct. These are three white guys who had actually committed sexual offenses. Went to court. They went to court themselves because they are free to do that. The judge who handled that case rubbished me like nothing for not agreeing to release them. If you see that judgment, it's scathing on me. We fought, we appealed against that case. It was about 2 months ago. We appealed against that case. We involved Judge Desai again. He spoke to the judge, and again, the judge scathingly went for us and then told us, release those people. We had to release them. They're out there, released, because a judge told us to do that. In an atmosphere, because my argument was, in an atmosphere where crime is perceived to be high, sexual offenses and all of that, that was our argument. He didn't listen to that argument. He said, just release those people. We could not do anything after the appeal. I'll tell you the judge one day.
Yes, but Minister, I think that we still have some laws that can make life difficult and control these people. If the judge has said parole, that was not medical parole. I read about that, the three.
No, there are many instances where Minister takes this. We should say that.
No, I'm talking about this.
The one he's referring to was not medical.
Yes, the three of them.
I'm talking about was medical.
The three, yeah.
Yes.
Assault, all three have assaulted their wife. And it was fraud. The others was fraud,
yes,
as well, the two. But I'm saying, even if the judge have said that, let us, why not putting them on house arrest? Let them stay until their parole date, they are due for parole. I mean, we are covered by the Act to do these things, to put conditions on these people. I know that the minister is getting tough, very tough. The court, you can't. But members, do you have any other questions? Maybe we are going to ask the minister for closing remarks, and then we will
Chairperson, thank you very much. I think what we came for is something that's close to the department. Not only the medical paroles, but parole as a whole. The whole vehicle of social reintegration is something that should be close to our hearts, but at the same time, balancing our act, balancing our obligations to society and our obligations to the court. If we do that, then if you as members of this legislature can assist us in taking this vehicle forward, making sure that we correct where there's something that's not going right, and you involve yourselves with the parole board chairs and push them to the limits to do the work they're supposed to do without doing wrong things or unethical things, because we don't want them to do wrong things, but to take society along with them in the work that they do. And I do have that hope that the CDC Corrections, who is always on my on my phone all the time, where I phone him and say, Mseki this and Mseki that, why is this not happening? So I'm pushing him to the limit himself to try and get things moving. The inspecting judge's office also helps us. The judges that we have had there, all of them, without fail, have assisted us in giving us information, sometimes on areas where we were not particularly good at. And they come back with information, we read their reports, and then be able to use that those reports to get our work to be done efficiently. What is important is to be very efficient in this department, but to make sure also that humaneness of treating people with medical conditions that are fatal and medical conditions that are terminal, we still give them that chance to go and die in dignity at their homes with their families and assist as much as we can to make sure that we're not seen as a monster department, but as a department who stick to the rules but be as humane as possible in dealing with those kinds of issues. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Minister. No, on the parole board, I think that they are trying their level best. We must never, ever do that in pushing those people in producing a lot of cases per day or per month. We are going to cry. Because these people will say that you have said we must take this decision. They must do a proper job. We must never ever do that in saying they must produce 15 cases a day. Cases are very, very, very difficult and very complicated. Now, if we are pushing them to do that, you know, from the portfolio committee side, maybe we must also get involved in assisting these people, the parole board, when we are in our constituency, helping them, because it's not an easy job to push these people and saying that we want people. They are not in a factory. They are here to protect society in the first place. They can't leave or release a rapist who have done very serious thing, and then we Minister, on community corrections, I think, I'm sure that will also be the view of the committee. When it comes to our community corrections offices, I think that we are not putting a lot of resources, enough resources, into those offices. And we are talking about medical parole here and parole in general. So the very same people must do this type of thing that we are talking about. But when they are short-staffed, when they don't have enough vehicles to go, because that was the complaint that they were raising with us, to say they don't have enough vehicles to go in some rural areas, like in Nkosi Kolo's Plain. It's mountains, and they are sitting with a Mazda. They don't have a 4x4, for instance. So if we can really, in the new financial year, put more resources into community correction, let's look into that. Minister, no, I must say that I am personally relieved after yesterday's report of Judge Desai, because I was worried, and I said maybe the briefing will go about that, but I'm happy that you are saying no. It is his personal view to say that he will, even the commissioner, he will do that, because if we can't write laws when a problem comes out, then we want to fix it with something very quickly. We must think of the future and the consequences of that thing that we are doing. So I'm very much, Minister, I fully agree with, we must never ever do the mistake in releasing people's duties. I'm always talking about that, and that thing makes me very angry. A child of 3 years, and all of a sudden, this person is terminally ill, and he's complaining, he's sick and whatever, and all. We must be very harsh on this. I'm very much happy that you and the commissioner have said to this committee that no, that was not the intention of bending the law in accommodating people. I'm very, very, very much happy. Now, the Office of the Inspecting Judge is raising deaths in prison, and we as a portfolio committee must follow up on each and every report. I'm sitting with all your reports. You mustn't think that I'm throwing it away. I'm sitting with all your reports from each and every year, in year. So I'm going through it, and we must do it. We are spending 24 million rand. Last year's budget on you was 27 million. And we must take you serious to say that this report that you are sending, we must look into it and address this thing. But I'm very much pleased with the responses that the minister and the department was giving us. These things are getting attention from the department, and we will follow it up as the portfolio committee. But let me also thank the members here for being here. The parliamentary program is upside down, but very confusing, and some of them must fly back now again because tomorrow they don't have any other thing. They are only here to for this meeting. But thank you very much, members, for being here. Minister, thank you very much. Everybody who is here, the media, please, media, you were here. Don't hear things outside there. Yeah, report about things. Yeah. Don't say a source have told you about a thing. Say Minister Balfour have said this. Commissioner Benny Peterson, Mutseki have said, Teboko Mutseki have said that. Not a source. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. Sources. The lunch is outside. Can you please have something for to eat with us? Yeah.
I was just wondering what human rights and